Hi, this is Tony Robbins. Welcome to the interview portion of Power Talk. And I'm especially excited and privileged today to be able to sit across the room from a legend, a man who has continually touched people's minds and hearts and made sports history. And that is none other than Coach John Wooden. Coach, I really want to thank you for letting me come here to your home to visit with you.
Thank you, Tony. I consider it a privilege to have the opportunity to chat with you for a while.
Well, thank you, sir. Coach Wooden was a man who, in his 27 years as a coach at UCLA, produced a level of basketball quality and quality people, I think, and I think as a teacher that's really what he pursued, that has been unmatched. In his last 12 years with UCLA, he won 10 national NCAA championships, unheard of. A quote from a gentleman named Jim Murray, who's the LA Times famous sports writer, said that what Newt Rockne was to football and what Connie Mack was to baseball and what Wilbur and Orville Wright were to flying, John Wooden was to basketball. Those are pretty big comments to make about a legend like yourself. And I know you don't see yourself that way because you're so humble and you come from a different place, but maybe you can tell us, where did all this start?
I think it started in my early days when I was raised on a farm in southern Indiana. South Central Indiana, I should say. And I think primarily from my father and mother and perhaps a grade school principal. I went to a small three-room grade school, but the principal had a remarkable effect on me, which you don't realize at the time, but later on.
Yes.
And my father, too, who I, with only a high school education, I think he's probably as wise a man as I've ever come across. Tremendous common sense. And one of the things that he tried to get across to me and my three brothers, which I didn't appreciate probably at the time, was that you should never try to be better than someone else. And if he stopped there, it would leave you, I think, wondering, but he didn't stop there. He said, but you should never cease to try to be the very best that you could be.
Yes.
And when you think about that, and later on it came back to me and had a lot to do with my own definition of success, which I coined in 1934, that when you get involved too much in the things over which you have no control, it's obviously going to adversely affect the things over which you have control. And I think that came back to me later, and the things that we did on the farm, reading at night, and I think probably it's the reason of my enjoyment for poetry. There wasn't television or radio or things, and but Dad would read to us at night, and I think it's perhaps while he didn't have the financial means to help any of us go to college, I think probably he's the primary reason that I and my three brothers all graduated from college, all became teachers.
Wow. I know he gave you a creed to live by at some point. Maybe you could share a little bit about that. Is it true also that you still carry it with you?
Yes, I do. Tony, when I graduated from this grade school, they sort of made a thing out of graduation from grade school. I'd say that we put on our best overalls. And
yeah. All three of you, huh?
Yeah. And he gave me this creed and a $2 bill, an old $2 bill, very large at that particular time. And I would like to say I still have it, but I didn't give it to my son, so he would have it.
Oh, that's nice.
But he gave me that $2 bill and said, "If as long as you keep this, you'll never be broke." And then he gave me a 7-point creed, and he just very simply said, "Son, try to live up to this." And the points were something like this: be true to yourself and help others and make each day your masterpiece and drink deeply from good books, especially the Bible, and build a shelter against a rainy day and make friendship a fine art and give thanks for your blessings and pray for guidance every day.
Wow. And it sounds like you've really, that's been a major focus throughout your whole life.
I wouldn't try to say I've lived up to it, Tony, but I would. I've tried.
You've done a pretty darn good job. From every person that I've talked to who's ever worked or played for you, they say you really live by that creed and that you really walk your talk, Coach. I know you had some experiences early on that shaped some of your values. I remember reading, I think, in your book where you shared that at one point, I guess, one of your brothers threw manure on you, and you had a unique reaction to that, and so did your father, and I guess it shaped some of your future values. Would you share that with us?
Well, we were cleaning out adjoining stalls in the barn, and my brother threw a pitchfork of manure over on me and hit me, and I was very, very mad, of course, and I went after him, not with the pitchfork, but he was 3 years older than I. I couldn't do much good against him at that time, but I didn't think about that at the time, and I went after him, but in doing so, I called him a name. I'm ashamed about it, but I did, and my father overheard, and he gave me about the only real spanking of that type, I think, that he ever did, but I knew I had it coming, and you don't... when you know you deserve something, even if it's bad, you can accept it much better than the things that you feel you don't deserve.
Yes.
But I must say that he also gave my older brother probably one just as hard or harder.
And what did you learn from that experience?
Well, to control your temper, for one thing, and as far as using profanity, I don't believe since that time, no player, no friend, no official has ever heard me use profanity.
Yes.
I probably had something to do with it.
I understand you also, one of your major philosophies in life is that you don't believe in allowing people to go through emotional peaks, at least on the basketball court, and that you wanted people to be prepared and be able to enjoy their successes in a unique and balanced way. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
My players would probably tell you that they never heard me mention winning. I don't think scores indicate that you won or lost. I wanted no excessive jubilation because you outscored somebody in a game, or excessive dejection if you were outscored. I wanted them each and every day to just do the best they could to improve themselves, and not let a day go by with doing that, because that's a day lost that you can never recover. And I never wanted and tried to get these ideas across. And you can't just tell them once and think they have it. The last of our laws of learning is repetition, and I would repeat them, but maybe not in the exact words, but getting the idea across day after day. For example, I would say that after a game, if you met someone that didn't know the outcome of the game, I hope they wouldn't be able to tell by your actions. As I say, I want no excessive jubilation or excessive dejection. Feel good when you've prepared yourself, and you're the only one that really knows. You can fool a coach and you can fool everybody but yourself. I know that you have prepared yourself to perform near your own particular level of competency. It may be, but the other fellow's level of competence is just better than yours, and there's nothing to be ashamed about in that, but there is something to be ashamed when you know that you didn't prepare yourself properly when you had the opportunity. So that was my idea, and I felt that that would have greater effect on the outcome of games than if I was stressing in some other way, trying to outscore opponents.
That whole philosophy of really improving yourself versus comparing yourself to the other guy affected your scouting as well. I guess you really didn't scout teams to find out how they played. You wanted to develop a plan that would work against anyone.
That was my philosophy. It's been said that I never scout an opponent, and that isn't true, Tony, but I probably scouted less than any other coach, certainly far less than anyone that I've ever known. Yes, I wanted to concentrate on what we could do and try to prepare yourself. Now, I needed to know something about the opponent, but I could read and I could hear about others, and I would know the coach, and I would know the coach for whom he probably played, and I would know their general style, and I'd know whether they used a zone defense and what type of zone. I'd know whether they pressed. I'd know who were their better scorers were, and I'd know from the type of offense they use how that comes about, along with, of course, their own individual ability. So I didn't want to talk about those things too much. I'm just trying to prepare my team in our practices against any eventuality.
And preparation was the foundation of everything you taught. How did you really prepare your teams for games?
By trying to get them to execute near their own ability level. taking each game. It's an old trite statement that you play them one game at a time, but it's equally true. And if you start looking ahead, then you will not perform as you're capable of performing. Or if you dwell in the past because you did real well in the past, that's not going to have anything to do with how you're going to perform the next time. So you've got to prepare individually for each and everyone, and not let the what's happened before, what's likely to happen in the future, affect you, knowing that the only real way that you can affect the future is by what you do at the present, and what's happened in the past cannot. Now, I wanted them to have respect for every team we played, regardless of how they had done prior to that. Don't fear them. And don't give them no respect. You must respect everyone and just make the effort to execute near your own ability level.
I know that repetition was a major part of how you train people. As you said, it's one of the laws of learning. I think a lot of people in life avoid repetition. They think it's boring. What is your reaction to people who think repetition and hearing the same things over and over again is boring?
Yes, I think it's been said that consistency is the last refuge of the unimaginative. But I feel that that's the way habits are formed, is through a consistent repetition. And now I must change my drills a little bit, still teaching the same thing. And I might, as time goes by, change the amount of time that I allow for certain drills. Some groups will pick up a little quicker than others. You have to constantly be analyzing those under your supervision. If you're not, and don't make it fun. Bill Walton recently on an interview said one thing about Coach Wooden, he made practices fun. Even though we did the same things in many cases every day, there would be little changes, and he made them fun. Well, I never wanted him to feel it was a chore, but I did want them to feel that during that hour and a half to 2 hours we're going to spend on the basketball floor, that's where I wanted their minds 100%. I don't want them thinking about other things, and if there are people up in the stands watching them, I don't want you performing for them. You're just working to improve yourself. Now, but as soon as practice is over, you're not a basketball player. No, you're a student at UCLA, and that must be your main consideration, because that's why you're here.
I know that a lot of these values were installed in you by some of your coaches. I know at one time you were offered the opportunity to go play for the Celtics and go barnstorming across America for, what was it, around $5,000 in those days, when $800 a year was a huge sum of money? Tell me about that.
The old pro league broke up the year I graduated, and they were forming a barnstorming group consistent largely of the old New York Celtics at that time, and the Cleveland Rosenblum Celtics is the name that they went under the new one. And they did offer me $5,000. Well, I took a job at $1,500, and where I taught 5 English classes a day as athletic director and coached football, basketball, baseball, and track. And I turned this down, but I went to my college coach, a man of extremely high principles, a very high principle man. And I told him about this, and, he said, that's a lot of money, isn't it? Yeah. Well, it sure is, yes. And he said, is that what you came to Purdue for? I said, well, what do you mean, Mr. Lambert? And he said, to go into professional athletics of that sort, professional basketball? I said, no, I didn't. I came to get an education. He said, did you get one? I said, I think so. And he said, well, I think you ought to take advantage of it. But that's a decision that you have to make. You have to decide for yourself. But he was very wise in things like that. There were other things along that line that he did that probably subconsciously had an effect on me.
Tell me a little bit about Coach Wooden, the ball player. I know you're one of the only person that's ever been elected into the College Hall of Fame as both a player and a coach. What were you like as a player?
Well, I can only tell you what other people have said. I'm proud of the fact that I was been selected on the all-time high school basketball team in Indiana, and As a matter of fact, Oscar Robertson and I were selected as the starting guards on the all-time wow. team and on the all-time college team from Indiana. And I'm proud of that, but the game has changed so much. And when I read and hear things that list me along, see with either Oscar Robertson or one of those, I kind of chuckle because I know it isn't true. And but I'm happy that I was considered to be one of the better ones of my particular era. I enjoyed playing. I was considered one of the better defensive players, and I'm very proud of the fact that at my senior graduation that my coach had said that in spite of the fact that I'd just broken the Big Ten scoring record, that that never entered my mind, that I was one of the most unselfish players that he ever had and the best defensive player that he ever had. But more than that, he said, what made that, I believe he's the best conditioned athlete for playing any sport that I've ever seen. Well, now, condition I worked on. I knew that's something over which I had control. I didn't have control over my height, and the Lord had given me quickness and speed, and I could, by proper execution and keeping balance, and balance is more than just physical balance. Many people think of it in those terms, but you can't have physical balance unless you're mentally and emotionally balanced. That, yes. that must precede.
Yes.
It's like attaining condition. You can't attain the best condition unless your mental condition and moral conditioning precede it. But I know that today's players and the things, no, I don't compare with those at all, but I enjoyed playing and enjoyed being considered one of the better ones of my time.
How did you mentally prepare your teams, and how did you physically prepare them? I know, I remember you saying several times that your teams might meet teams that were more skilled, but they never meet teams that were better conditioned. And it seems like you used the same strategy that you used in your own life with your teams. But how did you prepare them mentally and physically?
Well, I would tell them that we must be in the best possible physical condition. We may not be able to be better than others because maybe the other fellows try and do the same thing. But we do have control of our own conditioning. We must make the effort, and it's a combined effort. I have a responsibility to devise drills, and I must study and analyze each one of you and have drills individual, and drills. Some drills will be good for all, and some drills will be good just for certain individuals. I must know how to apply these drills in practice. I must not continue them too long. I must know as the season progresses how they're going to change, and I know how I must devise new ones to prevent monotony, and all of those things that I must do. But young men, you have responsibility too. Your responsibility begins every day when practice ends until you return, because you can tear down more between practices than we can possibly build up during practices. And I know that many of you are probably thinking I'm speaking of immoral conduct, and certainly that isn't conducive to the best physical condition. But we must just practice moderation in all things. And if you practice moderation in your eating and rest habits and other things, then with my living up to my responsibilities, we'll come close to realizing the physical condition that we're capable of. We can't do it perfectly because no one can be perfect, but let's work toward that end. And I tried to get them to accept that and to say, now, if this is going to pay dividends for us, we must put pressure on our opponent from the very beginning, and not just on defense, but on offense. We must keep pressure. We must try the fast break every time, but we mustn't end with a bad shot. But we must make them move to get back and make them aware of that. And if we are in better condition, before the end of a half, it'll begin to pay dividends, and before the game is over, it will pay dividends. Now, my problem was to sell that to the players.
And, when they were exhausted.
I tried to do it, but I didn't condition by running laps or running up and down stairs or doing push-ups or running penny cup games and things of that sort. I did it through the individual fundamental drills. A shooting drill for us was a conditioning drill, the way I ran it. There was no resting in between, always working.
Well, move, move, move was the, I think, the most famous phrase that most of your players say that you used over and over again. And they said that your practices, from what I understand, you would spend an hour designing a 90-minute practice that was literally to that level of precision. Did you do that regularly and consistently, and why?
Yes, I did. I think I learned that from high school and possibly from my teaching English classes, that I had to have a plan I'd have a lesson plan for every day. And when I first started teaching, I understood that in teaching English classes. I didn't understand it the way I should have in teaching the various sports that I taught. But I learned that we must be prepared. Otherwise, we're going to waste an enormous amount of time. As a matter of fact, Tony, I'd say my years at UCLA, I probably spent 2 hours every morning with assistants when I had assistants. I didn't always have them. The last few years I did have, planning the practice session for that afternoon, which will never last over 2 hours, and probably most of the season will be only an hour and a half. But it's practice the full time. It isn't talking. I did very little. I'm talking while a drill's going on, talking [S2] Yes. [S1] To individuals. I did more individual coaching in that sense. Now, I have, I don't have it now because I haven't given it to one of my friends in the coaching profession, but I could have given you every minute of every day of practice I ever had at UCLA. I kept it in a loose-leaf notebook, and when we planned it, I would have it by the minute, and then I put that on. Some of my players call me the 3x5 man because I had our practices on a 3x5 card, which I would watch carefully. My managers had it, so they'd know that at this time they better have two balls at this basket and two balls there, and players would move quickly from one to another. And when I planned a day's practice, I looked back to see what we'd done on the corresponding day last year and the year before. Now, that took care of every practice that any player I had in which he had participated, because wow, freshmen were ineligible. So otherwise, I'd have gone back 3 years. And after the day of practice is over, I sat down in the dressing room and wrote down some notes on the back of this 3x5 card about the practice. And then the next day, when I'm planning the practice the next day, I made little notations along the indenture along this theme paper about certain things, that maybe this was 2 minutes too long, or I needed wow, 2 more minutes, or things of that sort. And by reviewing back and thinking and analyzing all that, and then thinking in terms of what's coming up this weekend, if we got into the season where we're playing games and who we're playing and where we're playing and so on, analyzing, taking all these things in consideration. But I enjoyed doing that, and I enjoyed teaching. And you may have heard me say, heard of me being quoted as saying that Cervantes said, "The road is better than the end."
Yes.
And I sort of equate that with practicing and the games. And I think it was Robert Louis Stevenson said, "It's better to travel hopefully than to arrive."
Yes.
And that's about the same thing. And I really enjoyed it. And now, since my retirement, I've been asked so many times, do I miss it? I miss the practices and working with the players and the planning of the practices. And I don't miss the games or the tournaments or all the other fol-de-rol.
The amount of precision that you've had in your instruction. I understand you kept statistics on the players even during practice, not just in games. Is that true?
Yes, I did. There are many things. Now, I didn't keep as many statistics, but there are certain things that I wanted to know. I wanted to see what the trends were. I wanted to know, and not depending completely on my memory.
Yes.
If you start depending completely on your memory, well, I don't have that type of memory.
Well, you've got 80 years to remember.
I had, I did that, and certain things I'd not want to see if maybe we were going too much to one side of the floor than we were to the other. I want to see if we were getting an equal number of approximate equal number of shots when we got into our 5-on-5 work for each position on the floor, and some players will get more just because they're more gifted and can do more individually. But I wanted the vast majority of our shots, for example, on offense, to come from within the framework of our team, not an individual. I disliked one-on-one basketball and wanted it to come out of the team. But there are times when you do have the one-on-one. So I wanted to primarily check trends. That's why I kept certain statistics.
I know I've done quite a bit of research about the Japanese style of management, and you know, one of the philosophies that actually the most of Japanese business is built on came from Dr. Edward Deming, who we talked about a little bit earlier. And his whole philosophy is based upon the idea of never-ending improvement, that every day you must improve something and that you have to measure it so that you know that that's really true. How do your philosophies dovetail with Deming's, or vice versa, maybe his with yours?
Well, certainly That's my belief too, that you never stand still. You're either moving upward a little bit or you're going the other way a little bit. We can't expect to go upward too quickly, but we can sure go down very quickly. The slide down can be in a hurry.
Yes.
Progress comes steady if you're preparing yourself for that. You're given it the consideration of all aspects that you should. You must not let adversity, if you seem to be held up, bother you. Because good things, and these are the ideas that I tried to get across, all good things come through adversity.
And yet most people try to avoid adversity.
Yes, and as someone said, when I look back, it seems to me all the grief that had to be left me when the pain was over, stronger than I was before. And I believe that. You get stronger physically through weights, adversity. You get stronger mentally through increasingly difficult subjects in school. You don't start out with calculus. You start out with arithmetic.
Yes.
And I think we get stronger morally and spiritually through adversity to some extent. So, and yet we do fear it. We don't want adversity. And yet that's what makes us better. We should learn from it. And we certainly should not fear it. You can't get stronger, say, in an athletic point of view, if you constantly are playing inferior opponents. Mm-hmm. You may start playing to their level.
Yes.
You've got to be challenged to improve. Part of my job, I felt as a teacher, was to challenge the students under my supervision. And there's so many things that must be taken into consideration for that. You may be, I'm probably sure you're familiar with some of the things that Wilford A. Peterson has written. And I picked up many years ago one on the art of living. And he has others, and I just recently received another one from him. And under leadership, he points out some things which I thought were true, but maybe didn't concentrate on them as much. For example, one that struck home very much is that the leader must always be concerned in finding the best way, not in having his own way. And another one was that the leader must make sure that all those under his supervision know that they're working with the leader, not for the leader.
Yes.
And I think you have to do that now. In my basketball teams at UCLA, they're not playing for me. I didn't want them to feel that. But we're all working together for a common cause. And it's up to the leader to get that across and not get lost in his importance. Then he becomes a dictator type. And that doesn't work out too well.
It seems to me that in reading some of the documents and talking to some of the people that you've coached, that you really coached with tremendous strength. You expected a tremendous amount from your players, but they all perceived that you cared very deeply for them, that you were a coach of love.
Well, the coach whose philosophy I admired was Amos Alonzo Stagg, and he once made the statement, he never had a player he didn't love. See, he had many he didn't like and didn't respect, but he loved them just the same. Well, I, in my early years of teaching, I would tell my players, I like you all the same, and I'm going to treat you all the same. Now, I never did. I was thinking that I was, but I wasn't. I didn't like them all the same. They didn't like me all the same. They didn't like each other all the same.
Right.
And yet I was saying that. And I never treated them all the same. I didn't want to show favoritism, but I think the surest way to show partiality and favoritism is to treat everybody alike.
Interesting.
I think that's the surest way. I say, I'm going to try to give you the treatment you earn and deserve. And I have to make the judgment on that, and I know that I'm imperfect and I can be wrong, but if I am, I'm the one that's going to get caught up for it, because this is my vocation. And if I don't do things properly, it'll be found out, and then I'll be somewhere else. So in many ways, it's little things like that that help you do well in the end more than the techniques of the game.
Yes. What do you think you contributed most to these players? Again, I know your humble approach is you don't take credit for things, but what did you really contribute to these players beyond the basketball field? On a basketball floor, rather.
I would say that I'm most proud of the fact that practically all my players got their degrees, and most all of them have done well in whatever professions they have chosen. I'm asked so much, aren't you proud of all your players that played professional basketball? I said, yes, I'm very proud of them, as well as I am of the 20-some that are attorneys and the four ministers and the number of dentists and the number of doctors and the teachers and most of them, however, in business, because most of my players at UCLA majored in some sort of business. And while my 2 years at Indiana State, practically all my players became teachers and coaches.
Wow.
But not too many. A few at UCLA, but not nearly as many. So I'm very proud of them, and I'm more proud of that than I am, say, of championships. And if you would like a little later, I'd like to play something for you that means more to me than any championship
I ever had. Mm-hmm. What are some of the beliefs and values that you consciously really wanted to instill in these players that you thought would make a difference not only on the basketball floor, but again in their life?
Well, I tried to get across my definition of success to them, which I think is far more than just playing basketball. And my definition of success, which I coined in 1934, is peace of mind, which can be attained only through self-satisfaction in knowing that you made the effort to become the best that you're capable of becoming. Now, without peace of mind, I don't think anyone has very much. They're always looking for something else. And they don't see, the other side of the street always looks better.
Yes.
And they're so different. My favorite American is Abraham Lincoln. And he had that wonderful ability to say so much in just a few words. I think his immortal Gettysburg Address of some 268 words really says more than many volumes.
Yes.
But he said, it's better to trust and be disappointed once in a while than it is to distrust and be miserable all the time. And there's so much to that. And little statements like, the worst thing you can do for those you love are the things they could and should do for themselves. And I can go on and on with many, many statements of just simple statements which have so much depth to them. But I hoped that as far as my players are concerned, that they would think of me afterwards not as much as their basketball coach, but as more or less a friend, a teacher, one was really concerned about them as individuals more than just as basketball players. Not that I wasn't. Of course, they're there in all probability because of their basketball ability. But once they're there, I want them to know that I'm far more concerned in them as individuals than I am as just basketball players.
Well, that's clear to this day in hearing some of the interviews with these people. Tell me about when you first came to UCLA. Back, was it 1948, wasn't it?
That's correct.
If I recall correctly, you had two choices, UCLA and I think Minnesota.
That's correct.
And you'd chosen Minnesota, but an interesting experience of fate caused you to come to UCLA. Maybe you can share that.
Well, it was a snowstorm.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, at that particular time, Purdue was trying to get me to come back there very much, but they wanted me to stay at Indiana State for another year. And then they were going to let the coach go. And I didn't feel that was the right way to treat people. And I just decided I wouldn't be interested in Purdue. And Minnesota was also wanting me, and UCLA. And they had both offered me the positions. But there was a little hitch in Minnesota, in as much as they wanted me to keep as the assistant the coach that I was replacing. Now, they were not firing him. He wanted to be out, wanted to retire, but he still wanted to keep sort of a hand in it. And he was a fine man that I liked and enjoyed. But I just didn't feel that it would be best. I knew our philosophy of the game was different, and I didn't think it would be best. And they didn't have it in their budget for me to bring an assistant with me. So UCLA had offered me the job, and they wanted me to let them know by, I think it was 7 o'clock one evening, in April, and Minnesota, they were to let me call at 6 o'clock to let me know whether or not that they had worked out in the budget. There was a Board of Regents meeting with the director of athletics was going to be there with him. And he didn't call me at 6, and UCLA called at 7, and I accepted. And about 8, I got the call from Minnesota saying everything is all fine. And I said, well, I'm sorry, I've committed myself and I can't back out on it. And the reason they didn't get the phone, there was a what they called an unseasonable late snowstorm. I'm not sure that a snowstorm in April in Minnesota is unseasonable or not.
Yeah,
but anyway,
right.
That was the reason that he couldn't get the phone. The lines were down, and that's I would have gone to Minnesota had they called at 6 o'clock. That is true.
Well, I'd be curious about some of your beliefs about destiny, because I know that there are many experiences in your life like that. I know you were stationed or scheduled, rather, to go off to war in the South Pacific, and you got appendicitis, and as a result, you didn't go, and the man who took your place was killed by a kamikaze pilot. I mean, there have been a series of experiences like that. I remember reading about one of your associates, who later became an associate, Eddie Powell, who came to you. Maybe you could share that experience. But I'd be curious to know two things. Maybe you could share the story of Eddie Powell and what happened. Mm-hmm. But secondly, I'd like to know, what are some of your beliefs about destiny? Do you think there's a certain amount of this is predestined for you? Or is it a matter of choices? Is it a combination of the two? What are your beliefs in that area?
Well, I'm not particularly a fatalist. But
yes,
I do
good.
Believe,
no, not either.
I do believe that that there are things that... I don't know how to explain it. It's been said, you know, that... we may not know where our paths may lead, but we know they're being directed in some way. Mm-hmm. And I sort of believe that. And things have happened that's been unusual. Now, Eddie Powell, I had Eddie and his wife as English students in high school, and then Eddie played for me on both basketball and baseball teams. He was a terrible basketball player, it seemed to me, practices and everything. And yet, on the other hand, his sophomore year, he had a fine baseball player. And his second baseman, he made the double play well, and he was a good hitter, and was just a fine clutch player. He was on the basketball team, but he didn't get to play. Maybe I kept him on the squad subconsciously because of the fact that I needed him in the spring on the on baseball. But we had one time when he was his junior year, and it was early in the season, but we were rated. Now, there were three teams. They run ratings with the AP and UP and Indiana with high school teams, just like they do in the colleges. And there were three teams, or the top three, and they were... ourselves and Fort Wayne Central and a team from Gary, Frable of Gary. And it's by a quirk of the schedule somehow, they weren't in our conference, and this was before we'd opened our conference. We played on consecutive nights. We played Frable in Gary.
Oh,
and,
my gosh.
Then Fort Wayne Central, we played them in South Bend. And we had a tremendous game with Frable of Gary, and I think we ended up by winning at 47-45. And Eddie, of course, didn't get in the game. He was on the bench, and he didn't get in the game because it was a tough game. I'm not going to put him in a game like that. We went to a restaurant to have something to eat before driving back to South Bend. And Eddie sat over by himself. And I went over and said, "Come on, Eddie." And I said, "What's the matter?" And he said, "I might as well drop basketball. I'm not doing any good and never get to play." And I said, "Oh, Eddie, you must never give up. You never can tell what can happen." And if you're not enjoying it, that's one thing. But if you feel it's just because of lack of playing, that would be wrong. And he said, "Coach," he said, "I know if you'd let me play with Eddie and Jimmy and Bobby, and I know that if I could play with them, I could play well. I never get to play with them, and I know I could." And I said, "Eddie, have you ever shown in practices or games that you should be in there?" "No, but I know I could play if you'd put me in there." Well, I said, "Okay, Eddie, I'll play you tomorrow night against Fort Wayne Central." And boy, he lit up like this. And then on the drive back, I said to my wife, who always went with me, and I said, "Honey, I pulled another one, another mistake." And she said, "What'd you do this time, honey?" And I said, "Well, I told Eddie that I'd start him tomorrow night." And I said, "That's not right." He said, "He hasn't earned it, and he hasn't deserved it, and I made a mistake, and I must go through with it because I gave my word, and I must live up to it." I said, "I didn't tell him how long he'd play, though, so." But
you figured you put him in for a short time. Huh?
So I thought to convince him that Fort Wayne Central had a player who later became an All-American player at Indiana University, and at that time was considered perhaps the best high school player in Indiana by the name of Armstrong. So I thought, he'll convince Eddie in a hurry. And I put Eddie defending him. I use the man-to-man defense, of course, yes. helping, always helping on the weak side. My man-to-man defense is practically zone weak side. It's just man-to-man on strong side. Mm-hmm. And, well, to shorten it up, he held Armstrong to the lowest number of points he'd ever scored. He scored more points for us than he'd ever scored in all the games he'd been in put together. He got a number of rebounds and just played a tremendous basketball game. And was selected as our most valuable player at the end of the season and the wow. next season, well, and started every game from that time on. And it was sort of odd that some of the reporters said after the Fort Wayne game, Coach, you really were saving him for this game, were you? it was just a farce in a way that happened to come about. And it makes you wonder, how many other young people have you missed yeah. because of something like that not happening? And I still say I made a mistake by telling him to do that, but I did tell him, and it was a good mistake, it turned out, because I found a great competitor in there and played extremely well. Never practiced well after that either, but always played well.
He got up for the games. Mm-hmm. Later became an assistant coach for you, didn't
he? Yes, he did. Came out here with me after he was in the Marine Corps for 5 years, and he came to Indiana State hoping to play. But he had developed varicose veins, and he just couldn't play, and he was... I used him as a student assistant. I had no assistant, and I used him as a student assistant because he's a very intelligent player. And then when I came to UCLA, he still hadn't graduated, and he came out here with me, and I used him as a student assistant here, and he got his degree from UCLA and is here, and I'll be attending their wedding anniversary in a couple of weeks.
Fantastic.
He and Henrietta that were, they're sort of like Nellie and I. I never went with anyone but Nellie, and he never went with anyone but Henrietta. So
wow.
They're very dear to us.
That's neat. You offered him the challenge. You said that's what makes people grow. You certainly gave it to him, and he met the challenge. When you first came out to UCLA, I know there were quite a few promises made to you. One was the place to play, which I guess you didn't get for almost 16 years. And you also came out to a team that I think you were, if I remember correctly, a little bit disappointed with the base of talent that you had to start with. I think UCLA's team back in 1948 was selected to or predicted to place last in the league. What happened that first year?
Well, Tony, I'm correcting one thing that... has probably been misrepresented. I know I've never said it, but they didn't promise me a place to play.
Oh, I see.
But they led me to believe
okay.
that when my contract was up, that they were working on it, and there'd be a place to play by the time I'd finished my contract with them. So they didn't break a promise.
Oh, okay.
At all. I saw, though, before I'd been here too long, that it wasn't going to happen. Of course, right. It happened, my 17th year, I guess it was.
Yeah.
But... In seeing the talent when I had him, I thought, oh my, the team that I left at Indiana State, my team there, my first year I had 11 freshmen and one sophomore. Freshmen were eligible then because of just the war just being over. And so I had them all back the next year. Now I'm going to have them for 2 more years. And they were good. They're getting better all the time. And I thought they'd have taken this UCLA talent and trounced them.
Right.
But UCLA had had some good players the year before, but they still hadn't done well. They'd had an outstanding player by the name of Don Barksdale, an All-American Olympic player. And they had Davidge Minor, who'd played in Indiana High School and beat us out of an important high school game one time. And I remembered him very well. And then they had... George and John Stanis. John Stanis had graduated, but George was still there, and I had him. But the talent just didn't compare, actually. And I thought, it's going to be rough. But we had the best year that UCLA had ever had and won the conference. And that's one of the years that has given me the greatest personal satisfaction.
Well, how did you do that? How did you take this raw talent that didn't seem to be there and turn it into a championship team in 1 year?
I started a different style of ball that wasn't played too much on the coast, and I think it caught a lot of others by surprise a little bit. They hadn't used the fast break and been more or less ball control, and these players were conditioned to playing ball control basketball, and it seemed to me that they adapted very well to a different style, and that probably helped them tremendously. And maybe other schools were down a little bit. That I don't know. I hadn't seen them before. But I'm very proud of that particular group, but proud of any that won a national championship.
I know that you said many times that most basketball games are settled in the final 5 minutes. and that it's in those 5 minutes that you think you can win the games because the other guys are burnt out because you've pressed them all game long and you've run them all game long. And was that part of the strategy with your first teams?
Oh, absolutely. I took that, I think, probably from going way back to my college coach. And I felt that if you are in better condition, the only way to make it pay dividends is to keep pressure on constantly, both offensively and defensively. So we tried to do that. And not too many were doing that on the coast at that particular time. Not that they weren't well coached. It was just a different style. Mm-hmm. And I think that really is true. And I think that was true at the end of my coaching. Generally speaking, if the teams are comparatively evenly matched, the better conditioned team will probably prevail.
Well, they'll be in a mental and emotional state to be able to execute, basically, as a result of that.
I think so.
That's interesting. What were some of the key ingredients you were looking for in your players? What were some of the things that you really expected from them or demanded from them in terms of qualities? I'd be curious.
Well, I think from a physical point of view, the most important attribute that any player can have in any sport is quickness. But that quickness must be under control. If it isn't under control, you have a lot of activity, but you have little achievement. And yes. I don't want activity without achievement, which is another statement that I often use. Now, to have your quickness under control, you have to be balanced, emotionally balanced, and mentally balanced. And so that's what you're working for. To have the physical balance, you have to be mentally balanced to know where your feet should be, where your head should be, where your hands should be, and how the joints should be relaxed, and all those things. That is something that I tried to concentrate on as much as possible. I think in life there's two words that are important, love and balance. Now, maybe we just need the one, Tony. Maybe love would take care of everything. And I think it would, true love would. But you have to have balance. And balance is keeping things in perspective, not letting yourself get too high, not letting yourself get too low, and keeping all areas of your life, eating must be balanced. Rest must be balanced. Everything must be in balance. And that's what I'm trying to get across. So I'm looking for quickness and then hoping that I can help keep it in balance. Now, the next thing I'm looking for is teamwork.
Yes.
They must be concerned about the team more so than individual accomplishments. I try to point out that if the team does well, there's going to be credit for all. If the team doesn't do well, there's not going to be all that much credit. And you're all a part of the team. And so I'm trying to get that idea, and you try to point that out in different ways, like describing them as a machine, an automobile, a powerful automobile. Now, this player may be the engine.
Yes.
But how good is that engine if a wheel is missing?
Yes.
It isn't going to take you anywhere. And you may be just a wheel on this team. But you're no good if we don't have a nut holding that wheel on. And you may be just a nut that's holding the wheel on, but there's a role for you, and it's very important.
Yes.
Some are going to be more publicized and more in the public eye, but you're all important, very important. The role that you have is very important. And whether you players believe it or not, you need somebody in this car driving it. Because if you don't have me, you'll run in circles as sure as the world. So you need me a little bit. And that's just one way that I would try to point out the attaining. I used to use plays. You may have a leading character. If you don't have a good supporting cast, it won't be a play. It won't get many encores.
Yes.
We won't do well on the road. You've got to have the supporting cast. So everyone is important. So that's what I want. I want players with what you would call an unselfish attitude.
Yes.
That are concerned for the group as a whole. Now,
well, they didn't start out that way, some of them, though, did they? I mean, you're in a situation where you have a lot of players who had a fairly strong ego coming into your program. How did you deal with that?
A coach has the greatest ally in the world, Tony, the bench.
So pain is your ally.
If you're not afraid to use it, if you'll put them on the bench, they'll come around. I found that to be very true. One of the finest forwards I ever had, his first year, he sat on the bench most of the time when he's easily the best forward. And he'd say, you know I'm better than those. I say, yes, I am. Too bad you're letting them beat you out. And until you think more in terms of the team or get your play. And he wasn't a selfish individual. He was just, that's the way he had always played. And it had been brought up that way. It was hard to break. But when he broke it the next 2 years, I thought he was the best forward in the country.
Wow.
But that 1 year, he sat on the bench and watched others most of the time.
This session continues on the next CD.
If you use the bench, and don't antagonize them. You can't antagonize and get positive results, in my opinion. So you've got to do it in manners that you try not. This particular one of the greatest boosters I have.
Wow.
And yet...
Because he knew you were fair.
Yes, they must know that you're fair. Yes. They won't always agree, but another thing I always try to point out, that when we disagree, do we have to be disagreeable? I don't think so. I think we can disagree without being disagreeable. Gracious sakes, if we didn't disagree on something, this would be terribly monotonous.
And we're well, somebody's different. Not necessary. Yes. There's never a disagreement, right? I interrupted your flow, though. You were saying the other things that you really look for in a player. You were saying the unselfish attitude was where you were.
Well, first, the quickness from a physical point of view and the unselfishness the overall. They're the two main things.
Yes.
There are a lot of other things. You say you're looking for size. Well, yes. But like people say, I've had people say, wouldn't you like to have two Al Cinders? And I say, no, I'd rather have Al Cinder and Mike Warren.
Yes.
A 5'10 and a 7'2.
Yes.
Rather than 2'7'2 or 2'5'10s.
Yes.
That gives me balance. So I'm always looking for balance and trying to balance things out. Now, all coaches want the same thing. You want them big and quick.
Yes.
But where many of them would give up some quickness to get more size, I would give up some size to get more quickness. I wanted my guards to be quicker than opposing guards, my forwards to be quicker than opposing forwards, and my centers to be quicker than opposing centers. I didn't expect my centers to be quicker than opposing guards and so on.
Right.
But that's the one thing more than anything else that I'm looking for in a prospect that has the grades to get in UCLA. That's the first thing you always look at. First is, can he get in? If he can't get in, I don't care how good he is. He's no good.
That's right.
As far as you're concerned.
Right. What was the creed that you gave them? One was to be unselfish, but I know you had a creed that, just like the one you carried for yourself, that you reiterated, I think, time and time again with the players.
Well, I'm not sure of what you're referring to there, Tony.
Okay.
I had different things, little things that I put on the bulletin board from day to day. One time, I gave all my players a notebook. I had a lot of things in the notebook, and I noticed that it was getting a lot of dust in the lockers, some of them, so I cut that out, and I'd give them a little material day by day, and I had something of normal expectations, and that might be what you're referring
to. Yes, that's what I'm referring to.
There were just a number of things in there, like the one in the creed, make each day your masterpiece, and do the best you can each day, and never criticize a teammate. I was very strict about that, no profanity. Those things mean dismissal from the floor of practice, and if you miss practice, you're going to miss playing time.
Yes.
And a number of things like that. Always compliment a player that scores and not necessarily have to score for other things. If you score, never fail to compliment a player that maybe set the screen for you or gave you the pass or got the outlet off of the board at the other end. Compliment. And I had a player one time say, I'd say, don't run over and shake his hand while the other team goes down and gets the basket back.
Right.
But you can give him a nod or a wink or a smile or a point. And I said, one player asked me one time, said, what if he's not looking? And I said, I guarantee you he'll be looking. If he's not, I will.
That's great. What was really the secret to your consistency? I mean, you won 7 NCAA AA titles in a row. You had teams, I think 4 of those teams, that literally had perfect records. They didn't lose a game in the entire season. I think you had 3 additional teams, only lost 1 game. How did you produce this incredible level of consistency? Everyone wants that in life. How do you create it?
There's no secret at all. if there is a secret, it's to have the personnel that can do the job.
Yes.
Then the second thing is to be able to get it out of them. No coach ever did it extremely well consistently unless he had the players. Now, I'm not naive enough to say that players are different in ability and coaches are all the same.
Yes.
Because coaches aren't all the same any more than surgeons are or writers are or commentators are or people aren't the same. But no one, absolutely no one, can do it unless they have the personnel with which to work. And then now the big thing is to get it out of that personnel, get them working together as a unit and putting their own physical abilities to use for the group as a whole. That is the big job. And since every youngster is different, and thank goodness that's true, that the Lord saw fit to make it that way, we're all different. We're similar, so yes. Similar, but we're not identical. Even yes. Identical twins aren't really truly identical. So that's what the coach has to be constantly working toward, is to try to analyze, study each individual, and then work with them accordingly. My college coach, I think I got that from Moore. He did a tremendous amount of just individual counseling. Not calling you in and talking to you for an hour, but maybe one or two comments on the practice floor to me, right. To this person, to this one, and things of that sort, and which I didn't see at the time, but later on, in retrospect, like a lot of the things my father did, I didn't see at the time, but later on I see where it had it was meaningful.
Yes.
And subconsciously it helped in ways that I didn't see and didn't understand. So I think in trying my best and not permitting them to live in the past, to take, in a sense, each day as it comes, each game as it comes, and trying, working hard toward that one point in the creed my father gave me, is trying to make each day your masterpiece. And that means just doing the best you can every day. You can't do more than that. I've heard coaches say he gave 110% or 120%. Nobody ever gave 110%. They don't have it. You can't. 100% is perfect, and no one's perfect. So you can't even get 100%. I had an interesting thing. I was on a panel back in Boston with the late George Allen and Red Auerbach, the famous coach of the Boston Celtics, and myself. And George Allen was speaking, and he said that he demanded 130% from all his players of the Washington Redskins. And I said, Coach Allen, I said, did you get 130%? And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, I felt that I never was able to get even 100% out of any individual. I was never able to get 100%. I was trying to get as close to it. I thought 100% was perfect, and I just want to know how you got 130%. And he said, Coach Wooden, sit down.
You're messing up his rap. Tell me, you told me what success means to you. What's failure?
Failure is knowing that you didn't do the things that you should have done. That's failure. And you're the only one that will really know. It's like character and reputation. You're the only one that really 100% knows your character. Your reputation is what others perceive you to be. And it can be different from what one's character really is. And so I think failure isn't looked at that way. For example, success, Mr. Webster tells us, comes from the accumulation of material possessions or the attainment of a position of power or prestige. I don't believe that.
Yes.
I think they might be, I think they could be indications of success, but I don't think they necessarily are. To my way of thinking, in my analysis, an individual is the only one that will truly know whether or not they're successful, because they're the only one that really knows whether they've made the effort to make the most of what they have under the conditions that existed for them, and trying constantly to improve the existing conditions. Too much of the time, we complain about what we don't have. And as soon as we do that, then we're not going to make the most of the things that we do have.
Yes.
And if we make the most of the things that we do have, that's going to bring us more of the things that we don't have at the particular time. But I think that's a tendency for us to do that an awful lot. So I think success lies, again, within the within the individual rather in the eyes of others.
I talk to people very often who have become quote-unquote successful by cultural standards, as you define it, and some of which that are considered to be, quote, at the top. And yet, rarely do I find them very happy. And often the number one thing they say they're looking for is the very thing you mentioned earlier, which is peace of mind. Mm-hmm. What advice would you give somebody who's, quote, made it to the top and still is missing peace of mind?
To look around for things that they can feel that they're really helping others in some way, and there's always ways. For example, in the history of our civilization, many wars have been fought and billions of lives have been lost because heads of state differed with others, or leaders of some sort, in regard to religion or race.
Yes.
And we know that's true. And I think if those people in those leadership positions really had more consideration for others, those problems would never have been as severe. They'd always be problems. But I think that these prejudices today, and they exist, that you and I, you, others, are all somewhat responsible, unless each and every day we try to do something in our own little way to alleviate unjust prejudices. Now, people say, what can I do as an individual? You can't do much as an individual, but boy, we're not individuals. We are many, but are we much? And we become much when we all contribute in our own little way. So I think people that have seemingly reached the top of their particular profession or are perceived to have reached it at least and don't have a peace of mind, it's because that they're always looking on the other side of the street. And I think you should always be trying to do better. And no matter how well you've done, that doesn't mean you still can't do better. And you should always be trying to that. Although I know that there comes a time when we go downhill a little. We don't go uphill like that. We may go downhill pretty fast, but we can slow it down to some extent.
By constant demanding and improving upon ourselves.
That's right.
Right, that makes sense.
Each and every day.
What is a coach?
Well, they've been defined as many things. They've been called many things. You know,
they've been called many things, it's true.
By different people, but to me, what a coach really should be is a teacher. He's just a teacher, and he's a teacher just as an English teacher is, or a biology teacher is, or a physics teacher is, or a math teacher is. He's just a teacher. He's trying to teach youngsters under his supervision make the most of the abilities that they have in this particular thing, and realizing that the individual abilities that they have are going to be meaningful to others and not just for themselves. And if you become so wrapped up in yourself and lost in your own narrow tunnel vision, lost in your own egos, which we all have to some extent, and I think our strength lies in our ability to keep our egos down.
Yes.
But I think we should all have some. We should all have ego to some extent. It's pride, and we should all have some pride.
But we should earn it.
Yeah, that's right. We should not let it get out of a perspective at all, which the tendency might be at times.
How do you know when you've done a good job as a coach?
Amos Alonzo Stagg was asked by reporters after one outstanding season he had, well, aren't you really proud? Is this probably your best job? And he said, well, I won't know for 20 years.
Hmm.
So it's what your youngsters do after they've left your supervision that really determines whether or not you have done a good job. On a smaller basis, not as meaningful, when you watch your team play, how they play, do they play the way that you've tried to teach them to play, coming close to that, you can judge, feel whether or not I've done a pretty good job. If you just base it on the score, no. I felt that we have been in games that we outscored our opponent that, in my opinion, we lost. And we've been in games where the opponent outscored us.
Yes.
That I felt we've won. We did. We came close to our ability. I did a pretty good job of helping them reaching their maximum ability that I could expect at this particular time of the season.
Yeah.
So I think that's your job as a teacher. in the mid-30s, I read something that said, no written word, no spoken plea can teach our youth what they should be, nor all the books on all the shelves. It's what the teachers are themselves. And that's what a teacher, a coach should be. I think a coach has a responsibility to be a model, to set an example. And those that don't, I don't, in my opinion, don't think they should be working with our youth.
You know, I think one of the most important things to teach anyone and to be a model of is how to deal with disappointment, because they're inevitable in life. And I think when most people think of you, Coach Wooden, they don't think of disappointment because you had so many victories. But the truth is, you spent almost 16 years before you had your first national championship, and I don't think most people really think about those 16 years. Most people would give up, or some coaching careers are over in 16 years. No one would have known who you were. So how did you make it through those 16 years before you finally had a championship, and what happened to those 16 years? Did you continue to learn and grow? Is that why you created the momentum that created those 10 national championships?
I'd like to feel that I learned every year.
Yes.
I feel that there were some years prior to our winning our first national championship that we would have had a better chance to win had I known what I knew when we did win.
Yes.
And I think there was a time when I wanted to win. I'm kind of ashamed to say it, but it's the truth. And I wanted to win so much that I hurt our chances by perhaps overworking our players.
Yes.
Or by trying to give them too much.
Yes.
And once we did start where we were winning national, now we won a lot of conference championships, and from the winning point of view, I had nothing. People didn't perceive me to be a failure.
Sure.
They didn't perceive me to be a failure, you know, Tony, until we won at one time two championships in a row, and then the next year we didn't win a conference. Then I failed. And then we win seven in a row, and then we lose to North Carolina State in a double overtime in the Final Four, the champion who lost only one game all year, and then I failed. And then we come back and won the championship the next year, so I left as you know, being a winner. But had we lost that last year, I'd go back to a loser again.
I remember reading in your book, you said the more successful you become, the more criticism you hear, the more suspicious people are of you, and the more they expect, you know, from you, and they appreciate you less. So what advice would you give to people that are succeeding, and in terms of how to deal with this, and also how can people deal with disappointment? Because even though you were a winning coach, you still had disappointments. How do you deal with those? I asked you two questions, actually. Yeah. I dumped two big ones on you there.
Well, that's another thing that I tried to get across to my players, that at times they're going to be receive criticism that won't be fair, won't be just, and you won't like it. And you're going to receive a criticism that really you deserve. You won't like that either. But there are going to be times when you're going to receive a credit and praise that you really don't deserve, but you'll like it. Mm-hmm. And even whether you deserve it or not, you'll like it. But your strength, your absolute strength as an individual, in my opinion, will be on how you are able to cope with both criticism and praise. Mm-hmm. If you let either one get out of hand, it's going to affect you in a very bad way. Don't let the good things go to your head, and don't let the bad things defeat you. There's always another day, and that the next day can be a good day, or it can be a bad day, and you're responsible for it.
How did you deal with disappointment yourself? Because I know you had it. What did you do to keep that balanced?
Well, I tried to keep it within myself, and for example, if I'm trying to teach the idea to my players to not let either their emotions show, then I must try to do that myself. And I'm proud of the fact that there have been various times when Nellie, my dear wife, was interviewed. She said, John never brought things home.
Yes.
That he separated his profession from our home. His family came first with him. And I don't know whether that's true or not, and I dare say it isn't true 100%, but at least I was pleased that she felt that way,
yes.
And I tried not to. Well, I don't know. Perhaps my early upbringing, I learned to accept things and didn't get myself too perturbed over the difficult things that would happen, but figured that maybe they're a type of learning and will be helpful to me in the future. I didn't do it 100%, of course, but
sure.
I don't think I let disappointment get me down.
So you try to learn from it, and you seem to have the ability to put it behind you rather quickly. Maybe because your focus was on improvement. I remember in 1960, you had, I guess, one of your worst seasons. Yes. It was like 14-12, was that?
That's
the,
right. That's my and, worst season.
That pain that you experienced was kind of like the bench for the players, from what I understand for you. It drove you pretty intensely, didn't it?
Well, Sam Balder, who was a sportscaster here, had said before that season, if UCLA has a winning season next year, I'll push a peanut the entire length of the Miracle Mile with my nose. So when we finished 14-12, in some sense, I might have felt better with that particular team than I felt with some other teams that maybe won a national championship. Perhaps they came closer to their potential.
Yes.
And I never felt, for example, while that's my poorest year of coaching, it definitely was not my most disappointing year.
Yes.
It's the poorest year from a won and lost point of view.
Yes.
But it's not the most disappointing year. But I had disappointing things. But my disappointments were not so much from things of that sort. My disappointments came through maybe knowing that I had failed with some particular youngster for some reason, or something in my family. Those were my disappointments, or disappointments in some players. If I lose a player for some reason, that maybe it could have been avoided if I'd have handled something a little differently, and things of that sort. Those were my disappointments, and I just had to accept them, that I'm going to have them, and I can't let them affect the future.
From my understanding, in 1960, you really committed to revamping and improving everything you were doing, though, at that time. Is that true?
Yes, that's true. But it had nothing to do with that particular season that way. It had nothing to do with that. As a matter of fact, I might have revised a little more my thinking after the end of our 62 year, in which we made the Final Four, because I learned so much in that, in that year, in different ways that I hadn't learned before. And I did make some changes then in my practice procedures and limiting the number of players that I used until games were really won or lost. Now, from that time on, I tried to tell all players that there'll be 7 or 8 players that are going to do most of the playing until the game is, the outcome is settled.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean those that aren't get to play aren't important. You are very important.
The nuts and the wheels.
Yes,
that's
yes.
Right.
Yeah, and that's the job, is to get them to believe that.
Yes.
And go along with you. So that's the more difficult type of things that you, with which you have to cope.
Tell me a little about your pyramid of success that you shared with your players.
I talked to them over the pyramid once a year before, a couple of weeks before practice started, and asked them to come in and discuss it with me if they had any aspects. And some years no one came in, some years some came in. But the sort of surprising thing is, I don't think there's hardly a player that talks about it after he got out that said he didn't understand it at first, but he had found it most meaningful after. Not too long ago, Kareem Lewis was interviewed, and they asked him that question about the pyramid, and they said he thought it was kind of corny when he first heard it. And
yes.
Later on, he saw it was a little more meaningful, and he began to see it a lot as he was finishing, but it had its greatest effect after he got out of school. Well, that's pleased me. Now, that derived from the fact that after I'd entered the teaching profession, I didn't like the way of judging the success of my English students. A or B was right. Successful. Most of us are average, you know, and C is the average grade, and yet parents seem to think that a C is appropriate for the neighbor's children. but not for their own. And if their youngster didn't get an A or B, either their youngster had failed or the teacher had failed. And yes. I just didn't think that's fair. I believe in the good Lord, and his infinite wisdom didn't create us all equal as far as intelligence is concerned any more than we equal as far as size or appearance. We're not born in the same environments. We don't all have the same opportunities. And I didn't like that. And so I began searching for some way to what I thought could make me a better teacher and give the youngsters under my supervision something to aspire to other than just a higher mark or more points.
Yes.
Then I think from my father's influence, I developed my definition of success.
Yes.
And in 1934, I started working on that, and I put success, according to my definition, at the apex. And then I started working on the foundation. At that time, I don't know how many blocks I'm going to have in it or whatnot.
But I did select in 1934 the two blocks that I selected as cornerstones, and one is industriousness and the other is enthusiasm. And I just don't think anyone can come close to reaching their level of competency unless they work hard at it, unless they like what they're doing.
Yes.
And I worked on this for the next 14 years on developing it, and I had many ideas, and some I discarded and some I kept, but maybe placed in a different position within the structure, because each block is placed in a position that I think is important, like the foundation, the cornerstones must be strong. Any structure is have any strength, solidity must have a strong foundation, and of course the cornerstones anchor the foundation. But in between those, I placed three blocks that include others. And we include others, we're adding strength, friendship, loyalty, cooperation.
Yes.
And then the next year, I put four blocks. I ended up with four blocks. Just when I ended up with five, then I started working up. The first was self-control. And the next one, it was alertness, being alive and alert and seeing things are going around you. The next was initiative, not being afraid to fail, knowing you're not perfect and you're going to fail at times, but you'll learn from them. And then the fourth block was intentness, and that's determination or persistence and not giving up.
Yes.
And then in the heart of the structure, I had three blocks, and one is condition, mental, moral, and physical.
Yes.
And then the skills, being able not only to be able to do what you're doing properly, but to be able to do it quickly. Whether you're a surgeon or you're an athlete or an attorney or whatever it might be, you have to do things quickly as well as properly. And then the third is listed as team spirit, and that's consideration for others and working together for the welfare of all, and trying to put yourself back of it a little bit. And then the next two blocks I have poise and confidence. There again, to do well, you got to believe in yourself, you have to have confidence. And you have to have poise, and I also coined my own definition of poise, which you've probably never heard. And I think poise is it's a very simple thing. And it, to me, poise is just being yourself.
Mm.
I think you're not acting.
Makes it a lot easier.
you're not acting. You're not pretending. You're not trying to be something you're not. Therefore, you're going to function near your own level of comfort. Now, these things all lead up to the last block, which is competitive greatness. Mm-hmm. Being competitive. You can't be competitive if you're afraid, if you don't enjoy a challenge.
Yeah.
But you won't have competitive greatness unless you're conditioned, unless you have all these blocks below leading up to it.
Yes.
And then next to that, leading up on the apex. That's the last block. But from the last block, I have patience on one side. Good things take time. And the other's faith. Mm-hmm. Faith that things will work out as they should. And we're getting back to the question you asked me a little while ago, we must have faith that things are going to work out as they should. But if we must do what we should do, too.
Yes, we have to make sure we do our part.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about how faith has shaped your life. I know that that you have deep religious convictions, and I know that you've consistently lived by those convictions.
I wish I could say that I had as much as you feel, Tony. I've tried. I have a deep and abiding faith that things work out the way they're supposed to, which is sort of like we talked about a little bit earlier, why, I don't know. But in my particular faith, the two commandments sort of tie in. The first one is, there is the Lord whom you must believe in, and the second is the golden rule, do unto others you'd have others do unto you.
Yes.
That's briefly what they are. Yes, very briefly.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, or as you've referred to him, Lew Alcindor, was when he played for you. Tell me, what was the impact of your relationship? I know you had a deep impact on him, but what was the impact of his relationship on you as well? I'm curious.
I believe we learned from each other. I never had anyone like that before, from a physical point of view, and not too many from other aspects too, the background and so on. And I had no realization of what a tough situation it is for him at times when people would make uncomplimentary remarks within his hearing. I heard one time say, look at that big freak, look at that big black freak.
How did he deal with that, and how did you deal with that?
I wanted him to know by my actions that that was not my belief, and I was critical of those that had. And when I heard someone make remarks, I would let him know of my displeasure of it and how wrong it was, but let's not judge other. As I told him one time, you know, you astonish people at times, and sometimes when we're astonished, we'll say things that we don't really mean, but don't think all people are like that. I believe, as I would tell him and I've told others, I think most people are good. I believe that.
Yeah.
I still know that we have to have penitentiaries and policemen and all that and laws, but most people are good. But I also know that there are lawyers that are disbarred every year, but I think most lawyers are good. I know
yes.
that there'll be doctors that lose their license every year, and I think the Hippocratic Oath is a tremendous thing that I've read. And whatever the profession, most people to me are good, but not all. But let's not condemn all by the actions of a few. So some things happened along that line that I would talk with him about. First trip we made to one school in our conference, I always would be last out of the dressing room, and he usually would come out last and along with me. And he must have signed, I'm not exaggerating when I say 30 to 40 autographs for youngsters. And then I said, "Lewis, we must go. We're playing somewhere the next night. We've got to get on the bus and go." And he'd say, "Sorry to the youngsters," and then he'd walk away in the big. And here would be adults say, "In who are you here? Look at the big so-and-so, too good to sign autographs," when that's all he'd been doing.
Hmm.
I never envisioned that before. I didn't envision the fact that he can't have an aisle seat on a plane because his legs are too long. I didn't envision the fact that he can't buy clothes and you may have some trouble that will fit him.
Yes.
In stores like most of us can.
Yes.
I didn't envision that the tables he's got to sit sort of on an end where he can turn sideways. I didn't envision the problems we were going to have getting beds at that time. Now they have many, many extra long beds, but they didn't have when he played for me at that time. And sometimes we couldn't get him. We get a king-size bed, it's crosswise, and sometimes put chairs and pillows at the end to make them a little longer. Things like those, things of that sort. But the main thing that I didn't realize was sort of like man's inhumanity to man, the statements that would be made that he could hear. And I hadn't envisioned these things happening. So I learned. I think I learned more tolerance in things. He was very bright, you know, very
yes.
bright person. And extremely fine team player and no problem at UCLA in any way. No problem in any way at all.
Coach, what for you is one of the toughest times in your life, and how did you turn it around?
The toughest time in the life that I've ever had is the loss of my dear Nellie.
Yes.
And that's been hard. That was 6 years ago, last March 21st, first day of spring.
You were married for 52 years?
We were married going on 53 years. It would have been 53, our next anniversary. But we'd been sweethearts since I was a sophomore in high school and she was a freshman. Just one of those things when we met, there was just some sort of, I think before too long, maybe without either of us realizing it, we'd fallen in love in a sense.
Yeah.
And it never changed. And losing her was difficult, but what changed it around was not me, but others, my children and grandchildren and friends, doctor,
yes.
Minister. I think all led. For a year or two, I had a rough time. Then I miss her just as much as ever, need her, love her as much as ever, but I'm wrapped up in my great-grandchildren and my children, and
yes.
I go on for them. But that's been the toughest, most difficult thing that I've ever experienced in any way.
What beliefs did you develop to turn that around? What new beliefs did you have about the situation? Did you develop any?
I think prior to that, to some degree, I had a fear of death.
Yes.
I have none now.
Wow.
None at all.
Why is that?
I'll
be
with her.
Now? You'll be with
what
her.
What other chance do I have to be with her?
Wow.
Is there any other way? No. I'm with her somewhat as I go around the room because in our condominium here, which she picked out and furnished, I haven't made a change. The only thing has been addition of great-grandchildren, which she never got to see. Otherwise, there's no addition, no change. It will not be, and I won't move.
She really was your coach, wasn't she, Coach Wood?
Oh, she was a tremendous help. Going back to our high school days, it might be hard for most people to believe, but I, as her parents said, that they had never known anyone as shy as I was. I was very shy.
Really?
And she recognized this, and she got me to take speech and public speaking in high school to try to help me. And that was difficult for me to begin with, but it was of help, and it was good for me. And she was a great help. And then later on when I graduated and went to Purdue and found it a little discouraging. There were no athletic scholarships in those days. Now, I wanted to become a civil engineer was my ambition, and that was probably the reason I went to Purdue. And I didn't know that you had to go to summer camp every summer to get your degree in civil engineering. And I was going to have to work in the summertime. I knew that I couldn't go because you didn't get paid for that. It's sort of like a laboratory, I suppose you'd call it. And so I was blue and down a lot. And she was her encouragement that I might not even have finished school. If
wow.
And I had no problem academically. I was a good student. And I'm very proud. I'm more proud of my basketball playing and the fact that when I graduated from Purdue, I received the Big Ten medal for the graduating athlete with the highest grade point average. I'm proud of that.
Fantastic.
And more so than being a basketball player of the year. I'd like that too, but the other one is much more meaningful to me. Then after we were married, when I got out...
You made it through the Depression together? And
yes, tough, but she was understanding. She wasn't demanding about things. Things were not the most important thing in her life at all.
What made her special to you?
To me, she was the cutest, prettiest girl in the high school, and I ever saw. So, to begin with, why she's elected me, I don't know. But she was just special because of her understanding, and I suspect that earlier she saw through me more than most anybody else. And my last year in high school, our high school coach came up one time and talked to her mother and dad. And he was afraid, knowing that we were in love, that we might get married and I might go to school. And he said to her parents, "Now, you wouldn't want Nellie and John to get married and John end up by, not that there's anything wrong with it, but maybe working at a filling station, making $18 or $20 a week, which wasn't too bad then, but you wouldn't want him to do that for the rest of her life." And Mother Riley said that she thought, and she told us about this, she said, "I thought, oh, if he can only make $18 or $20 a week, I'd be very happy." she was just special in so many ways.
She cared for people tremendously.
Very much, yes. I don't believe there could be a better wife or mother than Nellie, and she loved people. She was good.
She may have been your greatest success, Coach.
Well, I'd have to say that. I'd go along with that, too.
Yeah.
She believed. She was there, always there.
Yeah. She provided some of that certainty that sometimes you needed as support.
Yes.
What advice, I'm sure you guys had challenges in 52 years.
Oh, of course we did.
What advice would you give people living in a society today where people think of a relationship as being long-term that's 2 years old? What advice would you give to help people to stick to it and make a relationship work?
Listen to the others. Communicate. Don't keep things all hidden. As I mentioned a little bit earlier, if you disagreed, don't be disagreeable. Talk it out. And, of course, the final things, love.
Yeah, it's always the base.
Mm-hmm.
What is your most treasured memory?
Things with Nellie. Just various things.
That's nice.
are the most treasured. And then with our children and family.
Yes.
Things that are family-oriented are my most treasured memories.
What do you value most in your life now?
Well, I'm living for my family, my children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. They give me reason to go on and to do things and not become a sort of a hermit-like person. And I'm pleased that so many of my ex-players are in contact with me and ask me about things.
What are the most important lessons that you've pulled from this life that you think would be valuable to share with your grandchildren and to share with just people as a whole?
So difficult to answer that, but I would say that among the things that I think are real important, and maybe I haven't lived up to them to the degree that I should have, and that is that being concerned for others, being considered for others, the golden rule.
Yes.
Being considerate of others maybe covers a multitude of things. Well, they say there's a mystical law of nature that the three things that mankind crave most are freedom and peace and trying to think what the third one is. But at any rate, You can't have any of them unless you give them to others.
Maybe the third one's love.
Yeah. you say there's many things along that line, little sayings that I'd like to pick up here and there from the vision of Sir Launfal. But it's not what we give, but what we share. For the gift without the giver is bare. Who gives of himself with his alms feeds three, himself, his hungering neighbor, and me.
Wow.
And there's so much truth in those things. You can't live a perfect day without doing something for another without any thought of something in return.
That's wonderful.
I believe those things. Not that I've lived up to them. Don't misunderstand me at all.
Well, you've certainly pursued them on a regular basis.
Try.
I know you've said often that something to the effect of that success is only the result of the lasting things in life. What's your actual phrase?
Well, on that is real happiness and success comes from the things that cannot be taken away from you. And material things you lose.
Yes.
In time, you're going to lose material things, but it's the other things that are that you never lose, love.
Would you share with me what you alluded to, one of the great things that have touched you from your coaching career? You said there's something that really touched you from a player, I think.
There was a certain party arranged on my birthday by friends, and they tried to get as many of my players who had played for me at UCLA as possible there. One couldn't make it because of the fact that he's the athletic director and basketball coach at Christian Heritage College down in El Cajon, and he couldn't be there. And two or three days later, I got this tape through the mail from him.
This is an 80th birthday present.
This is an 80th birthday present from this player, and this is more meaningful to me than any championship. And I must tell you that when I played it, not knowing what it was or anything, that it got to me very, very much. Still does to some extent.
Must be quick, but don't you hurry. We can still hear it ringing in our ears. You were content to help us shine. That's your way. You always walked a step behind. We're the ones with all the glory, while you were the one with all the strain, teaching us how to play and live for so long, showing us how to love and give. Did you ever know that you're my hero? And everything that I would like to be. And I can fly higher than an eagle. 'Cause you are the wind beneath my wings. Have appeared to go unnoticed, but I had it all here in my heart. You worked much harder than the rest, just so that we could be the best. Everything I wish I could be. I can fly higher than an eagle. For you are the wind beneath my wings. never tell you you're my hero. You're everything, everything I wish I could be. I can fly higher than the wind beneath my wing. You are the wind beneath my wing.
Coach, I'm not usually real good with words, but it's not hard to let you know how I feel about you. I will never, ever be able to repay you for all of the words and deeds that you've given me. Oh, you've helped me in so many ways. Basketball? Oh, beyond measure. But most of all, you've shown me how to truly live life. And that's by giving yourself away. Oh, you've taught me to learn and then teach. You've taught me how to truly love, especially my wife and my family. Thank you, thank you, thank God for you, the wind beneath my
You see how that got me?
Yeah, I can feel how it got you.
And this is a player that was a substitute, never got to play very much, didn't get the glory that some of those that got, but he sometimes I think maybe I would get closer to my non-stars than I did my stars. Maybe I was more understanding and had more, perhaps, empathy, in a sense, because knowing that they want to play and they're not getting to play, so you make maybe a conscious effort, either conscious or subconscious, to keep a relationship.
Yeah.
Then your stars, you're going to get praise and acclaim and,
yeah,
and the media and all that. So I think that this is a player that never got to play very much, hardly at all.
And yet he
was a tremendous asset in helping the development of another player that I had and helping the team.
Well, there's a processional effect in everything we do, I think. And mm-hmm. when we drop the stone in the water, the ripple effect continues, and it obviously has throughout this man's life and all he's had the privilege to touch. Coach Wooden, how do you want to be remembered?
I'd just like to be remembered as a teacher who was considered of those with whom he came in contact, both under whose supervision he was and those who were under his supervision, and was really, really concerned about others.
Well, you were obviously a teacher of love, as this man said in the words he said to you personally, and mm-hmm. maybe that's the greatest teaching of all. And I thank you for the privilege to be able to spend this time with you. Your commitment and your dedication and your love and your dignity and humility are incredible models for anyone. Thanks for being such a wonderful example.
You're very kind.
God bless you.
Thank you.